All right, everybody, welcome back. This is week two, and we are now going to go to creating your mix of meaning opportunities. Hopefully you have created your menu of meaning opportunities for getting meaning, because we don't call them guarantees for meaning, we call them opportunities of meaning. All right, so once again, creating your mix of meaning opportunities. So we have been working our way toward a discussion of life purpose by examining meaning first. Our formulation here is that life purpose is more important than meaning. I say that again. The formula here is that life purpose is more important than meaning. We want to live our life purposes whether or not a given effort provokes this experience of meaning. But we're beginning by trying to understand what does provoke that feeling and what meaning investments and meaning opportunities make sense for us. We continue that work this week. So this bootcamp model has two ideas embedded in it: repetition and, well, novelty. Repetitive activities such as drilling and weapons practice help you improve, right? When you're in high school or middle school and you had the basketball portion of gym class, they made you do, dribbling the basketball over and over again, the same exercises over and over again to get the muscles moving and used to activity. At the same time, you learn a new thing or two. You know, such as with weapons training, you learn hand-to-hand combat, a new weapon, or escape tactics. We are going to use the same model. I'd like you to keep working on what you have learned about organizing your day around your meaning opportunities and your meaning investments, even as we push on to some new learning. Okay? So we drill the first part, and then we're going to add on a second part. But we're going to still keep drilling the first part, because honestly, scheduling your day of chores and obligations around the things that you really need to create and force schedule opportunities for, you're going to have to keep practicing at that. It's a whole different shift in your way of thinking, and you can't think through it. You have to do, the scheduling. That's right, folks. You're obligated to make sure that you get, a fulfillment of life purpose and a huge opportunity of getting meaning out of your day and the days that follow after that. So this means that each week you have two kinds of homework: continuing your work on past lessons and engaging with new material. So let's continue. Okay, so let's start by asking this question. What gets in the way of value-based meaning making? So your goal, if you would like to live authentically and in alignment with your life purposes, your goal is to make sufficient meaning and to have that meaning arise from and support your values. A sunny day, a bit of tomfoolery, anything might provoke the experience of meaning. That unbidden meaning is of secondary importance to the meaning that you make your way. In line with your values and life purposes, you take the phrase making meaning to stand for your thoughtful judgments about how you want to provoke the psychological experience of meaning, and not as an imperative to provoke those experiences at any cost. But the effort to make value-based meaning is such a serious and challenging one. It is not at all simple or straightforward to do the right thing when you want to do the impulsive thing. Many of you have goals, but you also impulsively just want to relax. And so there's that struggle with, there's what I want to get out of life, and there's just, I deserve to relax today. I earned this. So you relax, and by the time you're all done, you actually end up feeling worse, right? You're feeling worse you thought it was going to relax you, and in the end, now you're all stressed out because you just wasted a day. You wasted time, and in the end, sometimes relaxing feels great. Other times, it feels like you're just putting off a part of your purpose, and there's something that just feels wrong, off balance, or just something out of tune, right? So it is ever so hard to honor your values when your liberty or your comfort or, you know, your easiness in life is at stake. It is tremendously challenging to escape from or transcend your formed personality. I'm going to say that again. It is extremely challenging to get rid of your personality. It's extremely challenging to escape from the personality that you have formed by this time in your life. And it's extremely challenging to rise above it, to transcend it with its habits, its habitual demands, and its repetitive thoughts. I'm not good enough. I'm ugly. My kid doesn't love me. My kid's going to love their other parent more than me. I'm not doing enough for my kid. But I want to do fun things with them, but I'm not setting them up for life. And that's just the child aspect. I didn't even cover relationship or work. It's like, oh, you know, I just want them to love me, but you know what? I don't want to do this for them or that for them. I just, it's not my preference. And you know what? I am an individual and I deserve that. And of course that self-centered style of immaturity really does create its own problems in the relationship. But whenever they act negatively towards those very improper expectations, you react negatively because how dare they? It's a whole circle. There's a formed personality, and I highlight those two things because odds are you live in the United States and there's a lot more entitlement in Western thinking. Although I have seen the same styles of argumentation, you know, in areas like Germany or Sweden or England or, you know, the other, you know, half of the world. So all of this, there's a lot to work through. It is quite a project even to know what values to support in the real life situations that tumble before us one after another. So the phrase value-based meaning making is simple. It's beautiful. And it's powerful, and also it's very hard to live up to. Nature, without concern for the consequences of its processes, has produced a creature that can picture righteous living, but because of its exact endowment, can't manage it all that regularly. There we go. What we can do, you know, and I'm sorry, my vocabulary is a little bit high. I'm trying to have a sort of elegant, you know, podcast here, an elegant stage of teaching, but without losing the ability to be understood. And I apologize for endowments and, you know, bigger words. Basically, what I'm saying is this: nature has produced, you know, a wonderful creature in you. And you're able to picture what real righteous living looks like, right? But because of what its exact endowment, because of what it's actually produced in you, what we end up getting is a person in all of ourselves that really can't manage it all and can't really manage it all that regularly. What we can do is begin to identify some of the common obstacles that stand in the way of our value-based meaning-making efforts. Here are 10 of them. As troublesome as the first 7 challenges may prove, the last 3 are even more troubling. Well, here's one obstacle. I call it turning a blind eye on value. So one obstacle is the way we can turn a blind eye on value. It is both common and easy, for instance, to make a large investment in something that serves us, something that serves our ego needs, our safety needs, or our financial needs, but that is actually morally repugnant to us. That obedient choice becomes the elephant in the room, and we organize our inner life around not noticing our unethical choice. Okay? Consider a person who prides himself on his values, but can't walk away from his high-paying job as a tobacco executive, even though he knows all about the health risks associated with smoking cigarettes. Since he is not reporting any psychological difficulties, and he is a hard-working, upstanding member of his community, current psychology might look at him not only as normal, but even as a paragon of normalcy. Yet doesn't he know somewhere inside that he is living unethically? I mean, that's just where we are, even in our modern psychology. That's, psychology knows that that's wrong, it's unethical. But psychology also recognizes that every single one of us either has conquered or is being a part of something that's not really the most ethical. So this guy, this tobacco executive, his community may well make him man of the year for his charitable efforts. He himself may be almost completely defended against admitting that his job kills people. Nevertheless, he most likely retains at least a partial awareness of the elephant in his room. For the sake of his comfort, his prestige, and his paycheck, and for other powerful reasons, he has failed to make value-based meaning in this one area. And that one failure may amount to an internal indictment of his whole life. It is easy to picture the whole edifice of his life crumbling when, say, his wife is diagnosed with lung cancer. Now, this is an elementary and basic example to really show an easy example of right and wrong. You know, I'm not even beginning to tackle all the really wrong examples that you people and what you do to live your life and creating all sorts of entanglements of being okay with certain behaviors that you witness or are part of with your friends, but you completely condemn when you see it in other people, or even in people that do the same thing to you, and only then do you count it wrong. But I'll go back to our basic example. Many people who intend to do the right thing often find themselves supporting choices that they do not value, or that they even actively completely detest and hate. Career soldiers who value patriotism and find themselves fighting in a war they hate. Career police officers who find themselves paired with a corrupt partner but who can't see breaking the code of silence. Career academics who have stopped believing in the worth of their subject matter. Each may be plagued by an elephant in their room. Their value-based meaning-making efforts are thwarted and mocked by some large shadow in the center of their life. Okay, so a second obstacle we'll call giving in to desires. A second enormous challenge is the way that desires affect us, and the way we are pulled to give in to those desires. So this comes in two parts: the way that desires affect us, and secondly, the way that we're pulled into them. We might crave drugs. We may chase a dream that excites us despite its shady values. We may let sexual arousal turn our life upside down and watch the ethical life we have built for ourselves be torn asunder by one guilty orgasm. I have not been able to wrap my mind around the fact that people engage in this, but I see it in the world. It's in our media. It's a common, glitch in a successful relationship that is portrayed in our movies and TV shows. And yet everybody knows that it's just an impulsive choice. They know it's really not good for them, or or even their own integrity, but people still do it so commonly. And I've never really been able to wrap my mind around, how can you get away from the obviousness of you don't cheat? It just ruins yourself for yourself, you know. And I know it tears at people, and so that would stop me in the process every time. Like I just could not be less than the hero that I've needed to be for myself and for others. And so, but here now, for someone who has cheated, I don't mean to say that to judge you, okay? Because, you know, in the sight of God and all that, I'm no cleaner than you are. Because it says if you've sinned one thing, you've sinned them all. And I have more of a, you know, a materialism kind of sin. Some people might look at me and be like, oh, that's it. You just want nice things. You know, I don't go out and spend money and break myself to have them. So it's not that I'm even, you know, buying nice things. I just simply want them. And that's just as sinful, you know, as, you know, so I just say all that to, and, you know, not, and I can already imagine, you know, even some of my own friends being like, really, that's it. You want nice things, you know, and that's, you know, that's part of the envy and part of the jealousy that, you know, people really do live a standard of their lives compared to the kind of people that they are around. It's the reason why people want heroes around them to fall, because it kind of lets them off the hook. They think to themselves, I don't have to live that well anymore. This hero in my life, you know, he really fell from grace, or she really fell from grace, so I really don't have to, you know, put so much pressure on myself anymore. And that's why people actually love it when a good person falls, or even a rumor that a good person falls. It lets them off the hook in the back of their minds. So, you know, there's another freebie, you know, golden nugget for you folks. So understand that all that is human, and it happens regularly. At such times, those desires might even feel meaningful. Okay, you might think, oh, but you know, he or she, they just look at me in a way that I haven't been looked at in years, and they really seem to be into me, and I think this might be how I'm gonna achieve happiness and just feel validated and loved by somebody finally. You know, so maybe I can wrap my mind around it. I just thought of something off, you know, off the top of my head. You know, those desires might feel meaningful for you. I just need to escape. I've never even done drugs. But I need to escape this life. It's just too hard to handle. My mom and dad are just on me. My friends are terrible. They treat me like crap. And anytime I do drugs, I you know, they actually praise me, and I'm funny, and you know, the way I am when I'm on drugs, I get the most, that's the only time I get validated by anybody. It's the only chance I have to escape from reality that's gonna, you know, just be showing me that I'm not good enough the next day. I just need to escape. Or the other thing I said was, you might chase a dream that excites you, despite its shady values. So it's like, yeah, I'm gonna sell the drugs because, you know, even though I'm, you know, I'm the big man on the block, or the, you know, the big kahuna on the block, everybody wants to be like me. I can only live like this, you know, extravagantly if I sell drugs on the side or do something shady on the side. You know, I demand that I might demand my patients. If I'm a doctor, I might demand that all my patients get this vaccine. Because even though I secretly know the $4 billion in damages that it has, you know, contributed to vaccine injury or vaccine death, I just, if I have 100% of my patients get this medication or use this vaccine, then I'm going to get a $40,000 bonus, no matter how I feel about it, even though I don't make my kids be vaccinated, you know. I don't mean to get off into controversial topics, but really, just look at the data. It's not controversial. It's right there. I don't have any emotional attachment to, you know, needing to be on in favor of vaccines or against. I'm a mathematical mind, so sorry, folks, the stats are what they are. But that's my point is, people are chasing a dream despite the ethics. People might be craving drugs or someone to validate them when it's not the person that, you know, they decided to be with for the rest of their lives. And that's the thing too. Their spouse might be awesome, but they just are self. But you might just be thinking, I just want to feel powerful and liked by everybody. And it's amazing what people get themselves into. So as we are sitting across from an attractive person who is not our partner, and we're feeling wanted and excited, maybe we're relishing the archetypal power of that fairy tale moment. It is easy enough to be suffused, not only with desire, but also with the sense that nothing could feel more meaningful than this. We are built to have these exact feelings, and we're built to make these exact mistakes. We have a carnal brain layer, and it's very, very active. Trust me, living very heroically and with huge integrity, I'm very much aware of what my drives could be. You know? Yeah, I'm not built like an amazing bodybuilder, but, you know, I'm not built like the person that gets all the attention of the ladies, if you will. And what's kind of funny is, I don't even aspire for all that attention, but having a materialistic desire, sure, I would like to have that kind of renown. I'd like to have that kind of charisma to where if people flock to me, you know, a guy's guy and a girl's guy, that would be able to actually expand my circle of influence to do good. And so it's interesting how we wrestle with these thoughts. So I'm going to go on to the next obstacle now. All right. Now, thirdly, for our third obstacle, not knowing which values to uphold. Some people say the common phrase, it's complicated. So, thirdly, you may well not know which of your values to uphold in a given situation. It is one thing to value compassion, discipline, freedom, or gratitude. Now, those are four fine, laudable values. But what will you do when the principal at the school where you teach begins to censor your class materials? Feel gratitude that you still have your job, and that your principal didn't do worse, and because you are feeling grateful, ignore his intrusions? Feel compassion? Will you feel compassion for his concerns and the pressures on him to prevent free expression and take his side by not speaking out? Or decide to continue acting in a disciplined fashion as a teacher? Decide, that is, that the way through this moment is by maintaining a disciplined attitude? Or do you fight for freedom by speaking up and taking action? Any one of these decisions might be value-based, and it might align with one of your values, but how different the reactions are between the four. To take a second example along these lines, say that you identify yourself as a spiritual person, engage in practices that you consider spiritual, and hold a view of the universe that includes ideas like universal mind and spiritual oneness. You know that you want your efforts at making meaning to be informed by your understanding of the nature of the universe, but you feel stuck translating ideas like universal mind and spiritual oneness into values that you can name, into nameable values. Then a situation arises, say a diagnosis. Sorry, my jaw was stuck and I got into my Scottish kind of heritage there. say a diagnosis of a life-threatening illness. Now you find yourself doubly stuck, torn between taking an active Western medicine stand and, quote, trusting the universe, end quote, to provide healing. Part of this painful conflict has to do with your not really knowing how to apply your beliefs in the context of treating a life-threatening illness. Do your beliefs suggest and even demand a certain sort of being passive to it? A sort of passivity? Are you obligated not only to supplement your medical practices with spiritual healing, but also to go a giant step further and substitute those practices? You know that you want to make meaning, especially now as you confront your illness, but you aren't sure how to make meaning or even how to construe your own values now in this new situation. And that's just one situation that arises that's possible. We all have many situations that arise that, you know, definitely throw a monkey wrench in the gears. Okay, so the fourth obstacle is rationalization. Fourth, we can defensively turn a desire, and people do this, you do this, what, at least once a day? We can defensively turn a desire into a value through rationalization or some other defense mechanism. I'm so glad I finally got to this one. I can't wait to pick on it. Take the preceding example of the teacher and his principal. Say that the teacher opts for reacting with compassion, a perfectly laudable value, and keeps silent about the censorship, arguing internally that his principal is under a lot of pressure and that the compassionate action is to support him at this very difficult moment in his career choice. Perhaps this is the teacher manifesting a value and making value-based meaning, and perhaps it isn't. He may in fact know in a corner of his consciousness that he is not really practicing compassion, but rather actually protecting his job and his current way of life. Okay? This is that moment when he can walk home and be like, well, you know, when he said that, I was pretty mad at first, but, you know, I really see that, really, he's got a lot on his plate, and, you know, I really just got to support him. Or you're being a freaking coward, and you're just protecting your own butt. And that's up to the person. Not everybody will be the same. I think most people will be protecting their own job. But I think there is a small percentage, but there exists a percentage of people that really, they have a great relationship with their principal, and they know that this is just not the battle to fight, you know, the pick your battle thing. So, you know, or here's the thing, this teacher, or he may really not know that he has made this defensive decision and argue long and loud that he is doing the ethical thing. It is a feature of our species that because we want to seem ethical to ourselves, we will call an action ethical even when we've chosen it for some other more shadowy reason. And this happens all the time. And if you ask anybody, they'll never admit to doing it when it's about 99% of the way people try to make themselves out to be the hero and or, if possible, a victim while being a hero. Nobody will say, yeah, you know, I didn't want to mess with this at all. So I just, you know, I decided to shut my mouth and just be quiet. I'm not going to lose my job over it. I applaud you people who actually are those types to say that out loud. Seriously, it keeps the world honest. Or at least it puts a little honesty in the world. So there's that. On to our fifth obstacle. All right, number five, the fifth obstacle, we're going to call this wild goose chasing values. It's a fun name, right? So I repeat it again because you probably listen the way I do. I hear something, I'm like, wait, what was that? Oh, I wish they would just mention it again so I can pay attention. All right, so fifth, you may wild goose chase after values. So you might, for example, you might want to pay your rent, be a responsible person, help send your children to college. Yet, for many pressing reasons, because gambling excites you, because you know that you don't earn enough money to actually meet your obligations, and because it is mind-numbing work to keep your life afloat, you spend a great deal of your paycheck on lottery tickets. Can you imagine the people that don't even buy lottery tickets? They just spend their money on going to the movies. Like, they just don't even try. They just spend it. I imagine people with lottery tickets think that they're at least spending their money on something that could provide, as opposed to all the people that waste their money on food and drinks, right? You can rationalize anything as being better than something else. So with chasing after lottery tickets in this example, for one, in the back of your mind, what's your lottery ticket? You know, what's the thing that you chase after that has pretty much 0% return? So back to the lottery tickets. This hopeful yet hopeless gesture is your version of a wild goose chase. You argue that you're doing a reasonable thing and maybe even the only plausible thing in your situation. You might think, what? But I only work at this job and I'm pretty much not going to get promoted. But so it's pretty much the only thing that's going to do it, right? But the values that you claim to be supporting, like paying the rent or sending your children to college, they're not actually being served. Okay, there are people that buy lottery tickets and end up coming short for rent. That is the disconnect. So what's your wild goose chasing values? Do you spend money on things in front of a certain guy or a certain girl? You know, do you go out showboating so that you can attract? You know, what is it? Do you go out where your boss wants to hang out at pricey locations? Because as long as you put some FaceTime in, you might get, you know, taken more seriously. What money do you throw at? You know, what was there an online course where it's like, oh man, I can make great videos and I can do this and that with a simple $40 course that's going to show me exactly how I can make professional looking stuff, and it's going to, you know, I can do it with my kids and show my kids how. But in the end, you buy it and then Netflix comes on again because you turn it on and you just let it sit. You know, there's all sorts of chasing after values that you don't even finish the job on, right? Right. So let's go on to our next obstacle, number 6. Okay, so we're going to call this 6th obstacle competing aims. So the 6th challenge to what we're trying to do occurs when we have competing aims. And we have these all the time. And one or another of those aims announces itself so loudly that it drowns out our voice of reason. It is one of nature's cruel jokes that it turns up the volume to high when it wants us to notice something. So to use the analogy of needing to relieve yourself, in the beginning, your need is only mild and you can manage to ignore it. But if you ignore it too long, however, your body will announce very loudly that you have waited a long time to find a bathroom. At that moment, nothing feels more important. That's right. Mr. Sayer has yet again resorted to a bathroom analogy, and it certainly won't be the last. So likewise, we start shouting at ourselves that we desperately need that scotch, that our team must win or else we'll die, that those shoes are just so beautiful, and damn the cost, I must have them. Or that life is pathetic and a complete fraud, that this town is so boring that we must get away. We don't just think those thoughts, we shout them at ourselves, and we won't let up. At that moment, nothing feels more important than whatever we are shouting about. I might as well start calling this the temper tantrum, you know, obstacle. So, how easy is it to make value-based meaning while your being is shouting at you about this, that, and the other thing? It's difficult. We're trying to create value-based days, but we have these impulsive drives. We're like, I know, this town sucks. I hate it here. It's stupid. I can't make a value-meaning day because this town is terrible. All the people are terrible. You know, everybody on that street is, you know, sleeping with everybody on that street when no one's looking. And, you know, it's just the people here are awful, and sometimes those people are you. But you can think of everybody else. And the people that are not, you know, a lot of people don't really, you know, do that. So, but, you know, think of something, you know. There's a restriction. There's an excuse. Okay, what is it? What's that? What's your excuse? Think about it. I'm going to give you about 10 seconds to think about what's holding you up. I can't create a value meaning day because why? And I want you to think of them. I'm not trying to get you in a gotcha moment. Nothing like that. Because these are the real thoughts that actually get in our way. So, there's something in the way. I don't make enough money to build a meaningful day. And I don't like going for walks. So all the free activities are just boring to me. I don't care about them. I really just want... What did you say? I really just want what? Okay, remember that. Whatever that was. Let's move on to our seventh challenge. Okay, so the sixth obstacle, you could even call that competing aims. You could also call that competing values. So now, our seventh challenge is whenever we end up doing this, shifting values. So a seventh challenge, one of the more poignant ones, is that our values shift. A common one for women in relationships that are long-term, it's kind of amazing. Whenever there's a person who's just kind of tired and bored of not being able to have their ideal life, they actually start to take it out on their man. And I am being stereotypical because the studies show that women typically will take this lack of fulfillment out on their man. They end up doing less for them because, well, they're dissatisfied. So basically this guy just needs to be God and get you the satisfaction that you refuse to get for yourself, because you can think of every single reason and excuse, including him as a blame for not having a fulfilling life. Again, folks, I'm not referring to abusive situations, okay? Because while it's reported that there are more male narcissists than women, it's more reported for males, but that is because there is definitely a prominence that men just need to buck up, man up, and deal with their woman. Okay, so, but now that I said that, I'm still going to validate that women do get themselves into narcissistic relationships, and that is because they tend to be attracted to the types of scoundrel that have the confidence to act attractively. Okay, nerds, nice guys, the people who are actually better kissers because it's actually more meaningful to them, you wouldn't even notice them because they're so respectful, they don't want to interrupt your day and try to come up to you. Okay, so when people are trying to have, when women are trying to have competing aims, I will definitely go down this rabbit trail. There are competing aims, okay? The way you find a guy your standards, your checklist, yeah, that unicorn does not exist. It just does not exist. I just need someone who, you know, has the confidence to approach me and like make a decision. Okay, well, guess what? That person who has that confidence is also going to later end up being this complaint. Oh, he's so controlling, like he wants to decide everything that we do. Okay, see what I just did? The excitement, okay, of getting, you know, a fun way to meet somebody turns into a curse. Okay, and the respectful, nice guy, well, it's just, I'm afraid that they can't even have the confidence to make a decision or just, you know, do other things with, you know, a flair of domination about it. Trust me, nerds, apps, I'll just say nerds, but passive-seeming guys, they absolutely know how to dominate everything they do, whether it is dominate that debate about Star Wars versus Star Trek. You want to question whether or not a nerd or a passive guy can dominate something? Watch him debate about something as a passionate topic. Oh no, he can absolutely rattle your proverbial headboard, you know, that you never, you know, knew was possible, because you can't just tell people flat out loud. You won't say it to people. Nah, I just, you know, because everything comes down to sex, right? You want someone who can absolutely, you know, be everything you want them to be in bed. In the end, that's kind of what it comes down to. And a passive-seeming guy doesn't come off like they'd be exciting. I can promise you this. Not only are passive-seeming men or nerds more considerate, and they seem passive, they're more considerate, which means they'll kind of lay down for you sometimes in ways where they shouldn't. And then you, and while pleasing you very, very well, might I add. But in the end, you get used to that red carpet and you start to bulldoze over them. And then you stop respecting the very thing that was respecting the hell out of you. And then people actually end up crapping and peeing on a great relationship prospect, because it's just too easy. I get their approval too easily. So what's funny is, you know, the human condition is they disrespect what is great to them because it's just too easy. And they actually end up gravitating back towards a narcissistic, damaging, destructive person. Am I getting an amen from any of you people out there? Guys, girls? I know, I'm sure I am hitting a chord. I'm sure of it. Okay, so with these shifting values, I'll go off of relationships and I'll let that be its own course that focuses on that, because there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different variations and iterations of what can go wrong, of what you did wrong, of how you measured the situation wrong, and got yourself dependent on a situation that you can't exactly feel like you deserve to leave, or they deserve to have you leave. So, you know, there's politics, right? Yeah, there's absolutely politics. This needs to be a whole different course in its own, okay? And it has a lot to do with my recovery course that I didn't record, but I do for others. So let's go back to a non-relationship example of shifting values. One day, you may value beauty and decide that writing poetry amounts to making a value-based meaning effort in your day. But a year later, you might decide that poetry is mere words and that you value action rather more. 2 years later, having worked a lot in the world, you may find yourself flooded by the feeling that poetry possesses far more value and produces more meaning than the work you've been doing. So the value of poetry may shift countless times as you live your life. Each shift amounts to a small earthquake and a real meaning crisis. Okay, so yeah, does this kind of go into having a hard time deciding on, you know, which guy, which girl, which college major to decide on? It didn't, you know that if, okay, you start off on the bottom in your career field, it's not what you want, but you know darn well that if you scale that ladder, you can be a person of influence, which is what got you in it to begin with, right? But the work you're doing now on the way up is just like, oh, this is really not what I want to do at all. Like, there needs to be a study or a work path that shadows these people of influence that I want to, that I eventually want to do myself, you know, not the people, the work. hilarious. So think on that as we go into our irrational eighth challenge of our meaning opportunities. And that eighth obstacle is irrationality. So who knows? We may simply not be rational enough for authentic living. And that is something I wish most people would actually ponder on before they just jump into relationships. I have seen people on my own social media news feeds say, you know, why don't people love me? Why can't I find the right guy? I should just shop for women. Why can't I find the right girl? I should just shop for men. I've given up being bisexual because women are terrible. I might as well find a guy, and, you know, or vice versa. So, but at this, on another day, they'll say things like, I'm such an unhealthy person in relationships. Ha ha ha. Guess what? This is boot camp, right? So if you're listening, I'll tell you right now, if you are that person, do not, I repeat, do not get into a relationship because it's simply the romantic hobby that you feel you need to have while wandering aimlessly through life. Because you're asking that other person to go along for the aimless ride. And that's going to affect and distract from their life purpose. Because anybody who's distracted trying to find their way in life, they will either make sure that they're, that both people in that relationship treat you like you're the star of the show, or you're going to be made to, because you're aimless, you're going to be made to treat them like they're the star of the show, and that everything needs to revolve around their life because they have slightly more purpose than you do. You see how that, do you see how that kind of comes together? If people could just think about the micro levels of how each thought creates the next action and how those things become habits, and then before you know it, it's no longer an equal household. One person is deciding what the music is that you're going to listen to. One person is deciding what is going to be on TV or how long that TV is going to be on or off. Okay, I've seen it all. So, irrationality. Who can say whether our species actually tips the scales on the side of reason? Okay? Tomato plants, for example, are a lot more reasonable than us intelligent human beings. I've never seen a tomato plant get stressed out trying to be something that it's not. I do not see it struggling and crying and getting pissed off and destroying the field or the garden because it just can't become a eggplant. No. Nature's pretty darn rational. You never see a squirrel trying to be anything that it's not, or even thinking that it has that opportunity. The most it tries to do is wiggle its butt come mating season and hope that it's enough to attract a mate. That's as far as that crisis goes. But we are so smart that we become completely off course of what's remotely rational. This intelligence that we have, our prefrontal cortex, matched and in conflict with our carnal caveman brain, produces the most irrational amount of thinking ever. Aristotle observed that as soon as you choose a word like rational to describe our species, you've already completely falsified the picture. We are not rational or irrational. We are not good or evil. We're neither, folks. You might be thinking, wait, what? How did that? Wait, no, hold on. Let's turn it off for a second. Rather, we are exactly who and what we are. We are completely enslaved by the words we use to describe ourselves, as well as we are also completely inadequate, compared to those words. What I mean is we are a slave to the words that we have available to use to describe ourselves, but at the same time, we are inadequately described by those words. Those words are not enough to describe us. So we are a slave to our word bank, and we are still not described properly by that word bank. So maybe this creature that we are is so split and devilishly disparate, in like devilish, sorry. What I mean to say is I'm just so off in my train of thought here. This creature that we are, maybe we are so split in devilishly disparate ways, or different ways, like extremely different ways. Maybe we are so evolutionarily constructed out of primitive oohs and high ideals that it can chatter all day long about meaning, like I'm doing, but still not be able to do anything about its nightmares, its envies, or its fantasies. Do you know what I mean? So what I'm saying is people can talk all day long about their dreams and loftiness and their lofty goals and these wonderful visions for the future, for their family. We can imagine the best, most amazing things, but still not have any idea about my OCD, my anxiety, my nightmare, my jealousies, my insecurities, or my fantasies that I just at this point know they're just never going to happen. Isn't that amazing? This obstacle, irrationality, is paralyzing. Because think about it. It is pleasant to think that we are essentially, that's not a word, it is pleasant to think that we are essentially reasonable, but are we really? Is anyone really evolved enough or serious enough to make meaning? And can even the small minority of smart, serious, prospective meaning makers really rise to the occasion and deal with their ghosts, their phantoms, their desires, deal with all the problems of living, and opt instead for a life in which they make value-based meaning? From a pure philosophical standpoint, that we are neither rational or irrational, good or evil, the jury is still out on that question. That's why I tell people sometimes, though, so a part of this comes out when I tell some people, like, do not jump into a relationship. You're not fit yet. You're going to destroy that relationship that you have good meaning for. You are very well intended, but you're going to destroy it with your insecurities. You're going to destroy it with your aimlessness. You're going to destroy it by treating that other person like the other shoe is going to drop. So you don't go all in. You don't give them your all because you're afraid of how that sets you up for vulnerability. So they don't get your best. And then you're going to yell at them for how mad they get or frustrated they get, that they're just not, they just don't feel like they're getting the same you that you showed them in the first 2 weeks. There are people that do this crap on purpose. They're called narcissists. But there are people that they want something good, but then once it becomes serious, they do get scared and they actually behave just like a narcissist. There's the accidental narcissist, and then there's the flat out awful on purpose narcissist. And the key is to actually be in the middle where no unhealthy behaviors are happening. And the best way to make that happen is to observe what you're doing and tell yourself to knock that off regardless of what you're thinking or how it feels. Okay? You got to fill their love tank up, no matter how you feel about it. If you're going to be with them, you have a responsibility, and that's that. It's that simple. Be a tomato plant. If you're gonna jump in and have the relationship plant, and you're gonna be a relationship plant, guess what? Grow like a healthy relationship plant. Just do the things that make it grow. A tomato does not think, it grows into a tomato. It just does what it's programmed to do. Doesn't that sound awesome? Wouldn't that be great if we didn't have, now you're probably thinking, yeah, that'd be great to actually not have a choice, to not have free will. That'd be great if we were just plants, going and being perfect judges and lawyers and causing no harm, and being perfect doctors and causing no harm. Jumping into a marriage and producing, children and causing no harm. All stemmed from our thinking. All of it from our thinking. Isn't that amazing? So, what boils down to that challenge is a tomato plant simply does not have the intelligence to think about or have its own motivation. A tomato plant is not even motivated, but it does its mission with perfect execution if fed right. Isn't that amazing? A tomato plant has no motivation, but also has no lack of motivation either. It just does what it's supposed to. See how much that intelligent mind is working out for you? So that insufficient motivation goes in, that goes into our ninth obstacle to our ability to even try to make meaning or just try at meaning opportunities. Think about your menu, folks. Be thinking about your menu. What's on your menu? I don't know if I'd like bowling. Ooh, here's your biggest clue right there. You said I don't know if. If it's I don't know if I'd like that, I'm telling you right now, as your subtle implied coach, do it. Go do it. If you don't know if you'd like it, well, it just seems boring. Nah. You're getting to know yourself. Go do it. Go with friends too, because who wants to go bowling alone? That just sounds stupid. So, anyway, on to our ninth obstacle. So, as I've already said, that ninth obstacle is insufficient motivation. So, just as we may not be rational enough for this enterprise that we've jumped into, a life boot camp, we may not be motivated enough for it either. I'm just waiting to motivate. That is a surefire expression leading to the procrastination to where you procrastinate so long it doesn't even make any sense anymore to even start today. You have to push it off for tomorrow or the next time your career work schedule to child drop-off schedule allows for it. So as much as we care about our values, principles, and life purposes, maybe we don't care even more. Maybe we just don't care. By the way, that's the worst place to be. My advice, change it. Act like it's not even there. Do what you know is right. Trust me, this is one of those times where fake it till you make it is ethical and true. Just do it like you're obsessed. Do it like you're going to get paid $1 million if you do it in a half an hour. Something. So maybe we are essentially as indifferent, careless about our fate as the universe is about its own fate and our own fate. In that sense, maybe we are perfect little replicas of the universe. Meaning is infinite. Indifference is infinite. Which one's more true? Which one's, if one was more infinite than the other, is meaning more infinite, or is indifference, a stronger possibility of being infinite? And that I leave that to a lot of you guys. Faith-based thinkers would think, oh no, meaning is infinite, the universe isn't indifferent. Well, to that point, the universe doesn't know it exists. Okay? A tomato plant doesn't even know it exists. We know we exist. We have all the best, you know, aspects. We have all the best upgrades to our being, and we are terrible. We don't even do what we're set out to do. But the universe and the tomatoes, they have no idea that they exist. But they do their thing without a need for motivation and without a need for even being self-aware. Isn't that incredible? On to our 10th challenge. Okay, so the 10th and last, well, last for our discussion, that is, not the last of the challenges faced by a prospective value-based meaning maker, is the very nature of, we'll call it the rush of time. Okay? The very nature of now. Now just passed. And that now just passed. Now passes instantly. It's amazing how that works. And there it went again. Soon a minute will have passed, an hour a day. The rapid passage of time is a complete anti-meaning machine. Doesn't life absolutely require tactical slowing down? If a person, even a smart, serious, concerned one, is to find the time and space to make meaning? As it stands, the rush of time can rush meaning right off the table. This is the hand we have been dealt. If we can make value-based meaning despite all this, we certainly deserve a round of applause. So in case you would like to think about these 10 challenges for a moment longer, following are the 10 challenges reframed as questions that you might pose to and answer yourself. Okay. Number one, is there some large ethical dilemma in my life, like that of the tobacco executive, making it hard for me to reach my goal of making value-based meaning? Okay. Secondly, are my desires so at war with my values that they regularly trump my ability to make value-based meaning? Are your desires getting in the way of what you want? Your distractions, your lusts, you know, are they getting in the way of what you want out of life? Number three, am I clear on how to choose values in the moment when many values compete for my attention? Number four, do I regularly turn desires into values through rationalization? Basically, do I make it fit? Do I make things fit to sound ethical when really they're just desires and I just try to make them sound good? Number five, do I wild goose chase value by doing things that I claim support my life purposes but that really don't? Okay, if you're an internet marketer, do you wild goose chase tons of social media comments all day? You're on your phone all day commenting, and then in the end you say, well, I'm actually just experimenting on messaging. No, you're really not. You're wasting time. Wild goose chasing, hoping that some comment leads to some sort of prospect, to some sort of paid gig, you know, things like that. Number six, am I in the habit of shouting so loudly about pressing matters that I can't hear myself think about value? This could even lead to the toxic behavior of, am I in the habit of making more out of something that helps me be distracted from the main point of what I need to get done for my life and my day? You know, number seven, do I know how to handle the painful reality of values shifting? Number eight, am I a member of a species equal to making value-based meaning? It's kind of philosophical, but, you know, am I able to get over this irrationality and make meaning? Number nine, am I motivated enough and do I care enough to live my life purposes? Number 10, do I experience now as passing by so quickly that I can't seem to focus on meaning or value? So that's going to lead into your work for the week. So in the preceding discussion, it should have helped make it a little clearer why creating a menu of meaning opportunities and trying to implement that menu daily isn't quite enough. More thought and more tactics are required. Here is your next tactic: creating a personal mix of meaning opportunities that allows you to experience life as meaningful. If you think about all the possible foods in the world, you will discover that you are standing in a different relationship to each food item. You may, for example, respect but not love peas, and love but not respect ice cream. And you might both love and respect bread. This doesn't make a serving of peas, a scoop of ice cream, or a slice of bread better or worse than the other. If we're talking in the context of meaning, folks, not in the context of like healthiness. But it does mean that you are in a different relationship with each one, and that to keep all three on your menu requires a certain kind of awareness and its own effort. So it will be easy to keep the peas off your plate if you only respect them and neither love nor crave them. It will be hard not to consume too much bread if you both love it and respect it and maybe even crave it. So what's the short answer to this dilemma? Mindfully committing to more peas and less bread if you want a healthy diet. Everybody always comes back to relationships. I just don't feel like it. It's like, okay, what are you a part of? Because you sure as heck cannot refuse to clock in for work because you don't feel like it. There's too much on the line. You'll lose your job. But some of you think, well, if I just don't, well, you know, that's, you know, but there are people that are like, I just want to force my boyfriend or girlfriend to talk to me whenever I want to talk. And, you know, I think they should be nice and say nice things to me. And I this and that. So here you are. You're okay with controlling that they should speak when you want them to speak, that they should, and then what they should say, you know, in order for you to feel like you're part of something good and healthy and romantic. And here you're all about the control. But, you know, if they're, say, maybe their love language is receiving gifts, maybe you never get anything for them. Or maybe you don't even spend any time with them that is specifically their interests, and you don't even care anymore to see if, you know, you can be part of their interests. It started out that way, right? Or even physical intimacy. Oh, I just don't feel like it. And if anyone forces me to, then that's rape. It's like, oh, did you not hear the verbal rape that you're okay with? That they must spend their time with you the way that you feel would be fulfilling, you know, the time rape. Like, you know, this is, you know, and I know that's kind of strong to say, but for example, there are, I know of very disparaging, and I don't mean to pick on women, but, you know, for the sake of the male principle, that was the male principle. And the sake of this example, I'm going to use a woman, for example. I know, and I have heard of, and I have heard from tons of men who their wives absolutely trash them behind their back, and they simply can't really, you know, get it up for them. But if you were to quote these Christian women who absolutely disparage and trash their very serving husbands, they would remind them of that Bible verse that says, oh, it says, do not withhold, you know, for a long time, unless, you know, the devil should tempt you, that kind of a thing. But they're having it very one-sided. That's guilt. That is a guilt rape right there. So there are a lot of women out there that commit guilt rape because a man's just simply going to be made fun of if they actually claim that they're raped by their spouse. They'd be like, what? Seriously, dude? I can't even get enough. Man, don't cry to me because she wants some action with you. Like, oh my gosh. They don't even know the half of it because the honorable man's not saying, well, she speaks very poorly of me in front of others, right in front of me or behind my back. it's hard to respect that, and I can't, it's hard to think of her lovingly. So these are very real things. So a woman doesn't feel raped whenever she has to clock in for work, but oh boy, if she has a great man, not abusive, tries to provide for every single thing that she says she wants, you know, total servant, absolutely expresses, you know, passionate love and lust even after a long time. And then the mere idea of him saying, "Hey, we haven't had enough intimacy in a while," a woman could look at that and be like, "Oh, you know what? I hate when you ask for that. I always feel bad, and I can't. Okay, and if you're gonna force me to, that's just like rape." And it's like, wow, that really escalated. You don't tell your manager at work that you feel like you're being raped because you don't feel like clocking in. You know, I'm referring to a different kind of rape, yes, but so that's the main difference. There is a lot of entitlement that's getting in your way of leading a meaningful life. You want to have things your way, and you don't want to be fair, equally fair with others that you will depend on, not in a codependent kind of way, but because people tie back to relationships, it always comes full circle. You're either being fair or you're not. And then you get mad at the other person for getting frustrated, for getting overwhelmed, for doubting themselves. They're frustrated because they doubt if they're loved. And then that comes back on you. So you guilt trip them be about you feeling bad about it. And as long as they can just understand your pet OCDs, your pet anxieties, or, you know, well, let's just invent some special rules for you, shall we? And let's have them deprive themselves because, well, now that they know you, and you've guilted them into loving you and standing by you, then when it comes up again later, you actually do pull the narcissist maneuver, well planned out ahead of time, knowing that you're going to tell them, "I thought we talked about this, okay? I could tell you over and over again every day." And sorry, but they understand. They already understand. They're just not okay with the unhealthy behavior, and it's always going to come up the longer that they, you know, have faith in something that's just not going to happen. So I say that in the second person, and I say you because a lot of you need this boot camp and to get over your lack of care, your lack of motivation, your irrational thinking that totally favors you and is not remotely close to being as fair to the other person that you're stringing along in your indifferent, lazy, not going anywhere way of life. But you want to blame them for how their frustration makes you feel negative. Because it's enough that you already know this about yourself. Now you got this other person in your life that is a reminder every time that they try to cover up another heavy sigh, like, oh, they're just trying to get through their day without causing a fight. Right? Yeah, so don't play the victim. If someone acts negatively to a negative situation, they are acting appropriately. They're not being a dick, they're not being a jerk. They're being who they need to be, and that is an advocate for their needs. And there is a healthy way of rebuking or challenging an unhealthy behavior. Sometimes it leads to an argument, but guess what? That's healthy. And based on the way it shakes out, I'm sure there's a healthy side of that argument, and then there's a very unhealthy side of that argument. And when it's kind of like this, whatever in mathematics, what happens whenever you multiply a positive number by a negative number? Is the result going to be positive or negative? Negative, right? The positive is not enough to overcome the moment. When the negative is multiplying itself in a positive mix, a negative thing happens. Now, to those of you smart alecks out there who would say, well, if you multiply two negatives, you get a positive. Right. Something happens here. A positive does happen. You get two negative, vindictive a-holes together, and neither one's going to put up with any of their bull crap. And then it causes a fight that multiplies, and then they split. That is a very, very positive thing. And maybe they both walked away individually with a positive reflection, an honest reflection about what happened, you know, or not. Because if the other person's so negative, then the other person's going to be thinking of all their awful negative characteristics that led up to the demise of that relationship, and not even their own negative things. That's the drawback, is when irrational people label negative reactions to unhealthy behavior, they'll call that a negative. See? Rationalization. Oh, that's negative. You're arguing with me. That's, you know, I don't like that. And that's, you always do this. And so, see, it's rationalized that you're now a victim of the crap you caused. See how that works? So that's that. So that's the whole schematic of peas, ice cream, and bread. Okay. You're supposed to commit to eating the peas, even though you don't want to, but you know you're supposed to. That is healthy. That is going to lead to a more meaningful life, because you're trying more, you know, meaning-made opportunities. So, with the peas, exactly the same is true with respect to your meaning opportunities. You just have to commit to them, even if you can't motivate, even if you don't even care about, you know, how the other person feels, you know, doing the right thing. I just don't care. I just don't care. That's not a strength. That is a 4-year-old's little tantrum. I just don't care. That's not a point. There are some people that even go as far as to try to rationalize. You're supposed to rationalize with good sounding things, not rationalize with bad sounding things. Okay, well, I just, you know what? I just don't care. That's not a good rationale. That is a very poor, it's a rationale, granted, yeah, but it's a very poor one. So you will be in a different relationship to each item on your menu of meaning opportunities, respecting some of them, but not actually loving them, loving some, but not actually respecting them, craving some, and finding others to just be a matter of duty. Indeed, your relationship to each may well prove to be very complex, and it's surrounded by how language operates, what you fell in love with as a child, what you've been told amounts to valuable or meaningful work, and so on. Because of all this complexity, we must simplify. One way to simplify is to have the following sort of inner conversation. It would sound like this. I need a rich mix of meaning opportunities, since it looks like it will take a rich mix to provide me with both enough meaning and also the right meaning. Where does the right mix for me? Let me sort this out and come up with a, of course, you know, temporary. Let me come up with a sort of temporary mix of meaning opportunities that might work for me. Okay, so end that conversation there. By having this conversation, you move from the idea of a personal menu of meaning opportunities to the idea of a personal mix of meaning opportunities. A refinement that will go a long way toward helping you juggle such quite different meaning opportunities as visiting with your cat, writing your novel, remaining calm at all times. Imagine if you told yourself, no matter what, I'm committed to remaining calm at all times. No emotion will be entitlement to go off the rails anymore. Huh? See, that's something you'd respect, but maybe not crave. But imagine if you finally treated it like you had to do it. Are you okay with someone walking in and disrespecting you? I'm sure some of you said, nuh-uh, nope, mm-mm, be gone with them. Okay, let me ask you, do you have that same stance? If I were to ask you, Are you okay with walking in that room and disrespecting him or her? Ooh. Double standards now, aren't there? Yeah. But if they treat you the same way you just said, like you'd stand up for yourself, if they, when they act that way, you react very differently. No longer are you championing this hatred for disrespect. Right? Yeah, there's a lot of hypocrisy going on. And sometimes it's not even a lot of hypocrisy. Sometimes it's just enough to make an explosive episode happen that changes the course of everything. So maybe another meaning opportunity is being just open to love, not waiting for the other shoe to drop, and just doing what you're supposed to do, only engaging in healthy behaviors. Am I pressing his or her buttons? I should stop. It's not healthy. Well, I'm just joking, rationalization. Until you get so comfortable with all the joking that the only thing you have to speak is negative, just tearing them down things to say, chipping away at their armor as a person, making jokes. Might take 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, but maybe one day you finally start making jokes about how they look because they're a guy and it's okay. You can joke about how they look. You know, they're not a girl. Girls are insecure. Guys aren't. We can pick on them and destroy them because they're our safe target and we're cowards. And that's just what we do. But we're never going to admit that openly in front of anybody. Right? Yeah. Listen, some of you are really good people, but that's no excuse. Some of you really have tried to have a great, healthy relationship. But I'm sure only the honest people are really looking back on the times that they were probably a little bit too pokey with their loved ones and picked on them a little bit. If you're doing that, then you're a good person. You're actually reflecting. If you're sitting there entitled like, nah, he did this or she did that, and you know, nope, then you're probably a narcissist. Sorry. I said probably. Okay, there's tons of other variables. But, you know, unless you are flagrantly abused, there's no question about it. The pictures prove it, that kind of thing. But yeah, another meaning opportunity is switching jobs. Maybe it's doing more gardening. Maybe it's gradually taking yourself away from the daily news. Ugh. So you don't want to scorn or devalue the experience of visiting with your cat or enjoying your garden. If those are value-based, meaning-making experiences for you, right? Don't devalue that. Well, it's just a garden. It's just a cat. Don't do that. Stop speaking that way. You do not need to say that those, quote, aren't really meaningful. Well, they're really not that big of a deal. It's not like I'm doing anything great in my life by doing that. Stop with that talk. Or that basically what I'm saying is that they are shallow meaning opportunities, or that they're just indulgences masquerading as meaning opportunities. I don't care. If the only time you spoil yourself in the week is when you finally grab that chocolate ice cream out of the freezer, you better darn well do it. And that's an order. You need to do some sort of self-care. You have to schedule that feeling of just slowing down enough to just sit on the couch. There's nothing else happening. There's nothing else to attend to, and you just get to slowly scoop that triple fudge goodness and just let it sit there in your mouth. No rush, and you can just enjoy it. Don't devalue that. The time you're deciding to do something for yourself and cut off the stupid world, that is a great thing. I don't even do that enough. So still, engaging in just those activities is unlikely to satisfy you, sure, or make you proud of your efforts, or even amount to a meaningful enough life. But they are real and they are legitimate, even though they're unlikely to prove to be enough by themselves. Okay? So the mix has a lot to do with giving each one a ranking, like a personal ranking, okay? So the question for you to answer is this: what is the right mix for me? Try answering this question. Look at your menu of meaning opportunities. So create it first if you haven't done that yet, okay? So see my week one assignment thing. Go back to that if you don't really know what I'm talking about. And try to discern, try to figure out what mix might work for you. Which items just must appear? Like, okay, no matter what, these are the things that I just need to have on here no matter what. Yes, here they are. So, which items might appear only occasionally, right? You can't go out and spend $50 on yourself for dinner all the time, right? So, which ones appear only occasionally? Now, you might be thinking, become an entrepreneur to where I could do that every day. Make enough money to where I could do that every day. That's okay. That's a thing too. Now, which items satisfy which values of yours and which ones satisfy other values? So before you start on this task, however, please read over the next question since, that I said read, but that's my notes. So please listen strongly and very attentively over the next question since that will help you figure out how to proceed. Then come back and tackle creating your mix of meaning opportunities. So this second question you need to address is this: how do I make this mix fit into my real life? Let's say you've come up with your tentative mix, and it includes a great diversity of items, from being states like calmness or bravery, to daily tasks like working on your novel, working on something, to periodic tasks like having Sunday dinner with your mate, to recovery tasks like maybe not drinking or not surfing the net. And to be honest, I would even say recovery tasks would be maybe having that dessert, having that drink, because some people just don't take the time, they don't take 5 minutes to just go and make themselves a little nightcap. Not because they need it, and it leads to alcoholism or this or that. I want to be careful if you're going to end up needing it. It's like, oh my gosh, the overthinking already, right? For alcoholics, yes, don't do it. But it is a recovery task to implement self-care into your day. It's not about the drink. It's about the fact that you're just sitting down and enjoying yourself. This is for me. This is going to taste good. This is going to help take the edge off. Or just the fact that I'm doing something with the idea that it might take the edge off is going to take the edge off. Yeah, that's basically what it is. Now, you might be also now also list out the big change tasks like who switching careers. Who boy. I have a story. I'm not going to share it in this episode. It's already going long enough. But there's a reason why I chose teaching. There's one reason why. There's the one, it was an honest assessment of my very good skill of relaying information and teaching somebody something new. Totally true. Also, there's a fear of failing to compete in the world. I thought it was just a safe choice. So I went with that. I thought I could be really good at it, and I was. I thought it could provide for me. It did not, and it definitely did not provide for the needs of my spouse. Okay, money is a huge motivator, and a lack of money is also a huge motivator. Okay, not feeling like so dissatisfaction is the ultimate thing I'm trying to cure here in these 10 challenges we covered today. Dissatisfaction is ingrained and embedded in the construct of all the 10 obstacles I laid out for you. dissatisfaction is used as a rationale. I deserve this. I'm entitled to it. If I'm not going to get this in life, then I'm sure as heck going to get this. And no one's going to stop me. That script is awful. It's terrible. And it totally leaves yourself blameless of the fact that you created this crappy life that you hate. You did. Okay? You chose wrong. You shopped wrong. And then you treated it wrong once you finally got it in your life. For a lot of people. Okay? But the true narcissists are out there thinking, no, I was treated wrong. Okay? I'm sure you cherished what you had. Okay? And a good sign that you cherished something is talking bad about it and making sure it's, overwhelmed and trying to make sure that you feel served all day, every day. Right? Yeah, you have it so bad whenever you're talking bad about someone or something, but yet you're going to tell yourself you didn't create sabotage in your own thing. This is what we have to fix. Okay, and I've helped hundreds of people get over themselves. I've also watched a ton of people just stay in their excuses. And that's fine. There's no cure for this unless you want it. So what, does a big change task look like? Switching careers? Finally making moves to get out of that just a relationship that's, you're not married to them, right? So maybe get out of that toxic relationship, that rut relationship, where if this doesn't feel like your forever person, you should probably start making steps toward your change now. Plan it out. But without knowing specifics, you can't really blame me for saying I advise you to do this. I don't know you, okay? So I'd have to know specifics for you to make that decision because of what I said. Now, there's also the spontaneous tasks, okay? Like being open to nature or being open to love. What does this mix look like in real life? So let's take a look at a hypothetical menu mix of 6 items that includes writing your novel, being calm at all times, having dinner with your mate 3 times a week, staying open to love. Wait a second, how am I not open to love if I'm having dinner with my mate 3 times a week? The fact that you're already not having dinner with your mate 3 times a week means you're probably alienated either through busyness or on purpose. And that's creating a habit, whether you like it or not, of being closed off to open and free and uncontrolled love. Okay? The other tasks are changing your job and, say, weaning yourself off of the daily news. So remember that at the same time, you must deal with your current job, deal with all your other duties and responsibilities, find time to relax, and include everything else that must be included. So how do you do this? By having a conversation with yourself that sounds something like the following. You say to yourself this. Getting to writing the novel every day is simple to schedule and pencil in. I just put it on my schedule first thing each day before my real day begins. So easy to say. But of course I have to change my habits and deal with everyday resistance just to do this one thing. Okay, so I must figure that out. Okay, no complaining. Finding a fix, finding a solution. Okay, at the same time, I have to pay real attention to switching jobs because my current one is too meaningless and too poorly paid for me to continue in it. So how does that fit into my daily negotiations? Okay, well, I could look for jobs as a regular daily meaning investment. But how do I stay calm through all this? And how on earth do I stay open to love as I'm struggling to write my novel, trying to change jobs, and spending too many hours at my soul-sucking job? Okay, breathe. How do I stay calm and remain open to love in my real circumstances? Well, somehow these being states have to take priority. So in some sense, being has to take precedence over doing. So more concretely, that means, end quote, and so on and so forth. So you're starting to see how there's like a Venn diagram where no matter what you do, you have to stay calm at all times. So you're starting to see that there's a priority starting to form. Okay, I have to find a job while I'm doing all this stuff. I have to do this while I'm doing this. Pencil it out, write it out. Once you start putting pen to paper, you're going to see that it's possible. Okay, because sitting on the couch while watching a show in your escapism is just and you thinking about it while watching a show is just giving you more anxiety because you're not doing anything. You're just thinking about it and just imagining all the excuses and irrationalities and how tiring it is and blah, 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 blah. So that is the short sort of conversation to have. Now it's time to do the work. So four things before I move on to Margaret. One, create your mix of meeting opportunities, mindfully chatting with yourself about your rationale for your particular mix. Two, have the equally important conversation with yourself about how to live this mix while living the rest of life too. Three, when you've done this, live this way for the remainder of the week. Four, at the end of the week, please take a few moments to jot down your thoughts about the experience. All right, so let's talk about Margaret now, who has no perfect timing and no perfect plan, okay?